Hey everyone, how you doing today? Good. So I'm here to talk to you a little bit about OpenStack. I'm going to give a little introduction of myself here in a minute, but I kind of want to go through some history first. Just to get an idea, how many of you have used OpenStack before? Raise your hand. All right. And how many of you have heard of OpenStack before? Okay, good. So I don't have to start at the very beginning. So let's start with a brief history. OpenStack is software for cloud computing. Specifically, the part that we tend to refer to is infrastructure as a service. So let's talk about where cloud computing started first. Probably familiar with seeing this. It's a pretty nasty looking patch panel in the back there. It used to be that if you wanted to run a server to provide services to other people, you essentially had to have internet connectivity. You had to buy a rack, stick some servers in it, plug them in, turn them on, install the operating system. A process that could go fairly quickly, but often was something that was going to take a week or more just to get something online. Fairly early on in the process, this idea of hosted servers came along. So you could call up a company and say, hey, I don't want to manage my own server. I'm going to call you, and you're going to turn on two of your servers and plug them in and manage them for me. And this really changed a few years back when the idea of virtualization came up. And that was kind of a necessary transformation, because what started happening is the pace with which hardware was changing was outstripping the pace with which software could use that hardware. So essentially what we have in most IT organizations, as I'm sure you're familiar with, is a lot of underused servers. So we have these big beefy machines, and we're using 2 to 5% of their capacity. So virtualization gives us the ability to become a lot more efficient in how we use those servers by sharing those resources across multiple different virtual machines on one single hardware. And gradually this grew into this fantastic thing due to Amazon releasing EC2 that is just called the cloud. And today we have this term that's thrown around all the time, cloud computing. And essentially it means a whole bunch of different things to a whole bunch of different people. And that's why I put this wonderful little picture here of a light in the sky, because most people when they talk about cloud don't have a very clear definition for what cloud is. When we talk about cloud in this context, just to make sure that we're all on the same page, I'm referring to infrastructure as a service, which is essentially dynamic control of virtualized hardware. So how does OpenStack fit into the picture? We had virtualization come along, we had cloud appear. I'm going to give you a brief history of OpenStack, and this is from my perspective, so let's start with me. So I'm Vishishaya. Despite the weird name, I'm actually from Iowa. Anybody here been to Iowa? Yeah, we have a lot of corn. In fact, where I'm from is actually Silicon Valley. Not the tech capital of the world, but maybe the tech capital of the Midwest. There's a place there called Cedar Rapids where we have quite a bit of tech. But it's not necessarily the most fun place to work in tech, because we're not working on cutting-edge stuff. It's mostly very boring, small business kind of work. So I always dreamed of moving out to the center of the tech world, which in my mind was California, especially working in San Francisco. And I got the opportunity to move out to San Francisco to work for a project at NASA. This project was originally called NASA.net. And the goal of the project was to take all of the 3,000 plus websites that NASA runs for all of their individual projects, which are all managed separately, and unify them into a single architecture. They did a study of how much wasted money there was on IT spending at NASA to manage these 3,000 websites. A lot of them were servers sitting under someone's desk. Some of them were in data centers owned by different companies. Some of them were on-site on the NASA data centers. So essentially, everybody who had a project at NASA created their own website. It had their own IT budget, and it was extremely inefficient. So the plan was, hey, what if we could unify all of these things into a single set of infrastructure? So all of the websites would be served from one place. In order to create this sort of very platform as a service idea, we had to create infrastructure underneath it. And so we started using some open source projects to create an elastic compute infrastructure. This gradually transformed into something called the Nebula Project. Now, how it changed from NASA.NET into the Nebula Project is actually kind of interesting. It started out as this IT service to sort of unify websites. Well, it turns out the White House got involved. One day, the White House heard that we had created this sort of elastic infrastructure for NASA, and they basically said, oh, you know, we have all these websites, we'd like to use that too. We've been using Amazon, and we wanted to bring it in-house. And of course, to about half the people, this sounded like a really good idea because, hey, it's the White House. You know, whitehouse.gov wants to be on our platform. And everybody else says, but wait a minute, that means all of our resources are going to be going to the White House, and we can't exactly ask the White House to pay us. In fact, the reason they wanted to use this platform was because it was free. And so we immediately had about 10 times the amount of work that we had to do to support this new project without any actual revenue coming in to support the project. So it actually was quite difficult, but it grew the size of the project very quickly. And suddenly what we realized was that there was probably even a greater need than actually unifying the websites that are part of NASA is actually unifying more of the IT spending and actually providing infrastructure as a service. In order to get in government to get a new server provisioned when you need it, it takes usually more than 6 weeks. So you have to file a rec, you have to send it out, you have to get funding, you have to get signed off by 16 different managers, and eventually, you know, a month and a half later, you have a server. And there were all these scientists at NASA that actually really wanted to be able to do much more, but they couldn't get the servers that they needed quickly enough. So we thought, hey, if we could provide servers to these scientists in a couple of minutes, then they can actually get a lot more work done. So that became what's called the Nebula Project. So when I moved out, I was working for a small contracting company called Anso Labs, because most people don't work directly for NASA. And we created this Nebula Project. And initially, our goal was to use all open source software. Unfortunately, what we discovered was the open source software that was around at the time for creating infrastructure clouds didn't scale very well. We hit about 40 users, and it started crashing every day. It didn't do a lot of the hard things that would have been neat, and it didn't do the easy things well enough to be stable. So we thought, hey, maybe what would be better is if we just rewrote it. Now, you might wonder, hey, this is open source software. Why wouldn't you modify what you had already? The main problem was that it was open core software, and they weren't really too excited about merging the patches that we were proposing in. So we thought it would actually be easier to have a fresh start. So we created this piece of source code that we called Nova. It actually started in one weekend. Friday night, we said, hey, this weekend we're rewriting our infrastructure as a service layer. We didn't have any permission from the superiors at NASA to do this, so this was completely an on-our-own weekend project, and we said on Tuesday we're going to demo this to our supervisors and see if we can get buy-in from them to allow us to continue to move forward with it. So it's a big gamble. It was a lot of fun. It was about 8 of us sitting in a room in San Francisco over the weekend. We got it working by Monday. Tuesday we demoed it. Within 2 weeks we had moved all of the alpha customers over from the old platform onto the new platform. So it was actually API compatible with what we were using. And that was the birth of what we would later call OpenStack Compute. At the same time, another company, Rackspace, down in Texas, had decided that they wanted to adopt a new strategy. They realized that they differentiated their hosting company. You've all heard of Rackspace, yes? Yeah. They're a hosting company, but they differentiate by providing really good service. And so they said, we're not a development company. We don't want to be spending a lot of time doing proprietary development, so we're going to open source all of our cloud software so that more people can contribute, and we're going to differentiate on the service that we offer on top of it. And so they were planning on rewriting their cloud stack for compute, and they heard about what NASA was doing and said, hey, we should partner up. So it essentially led to the founding of OpenStack, and I'll go through a timeline, a couple of years ago. And initially, the two projects were Cloud Files, which were basically an object storage system and a compute system to control hypervisors. I was part of Anso Labs. We were eventually acquired by Rackspace. I continued to work on OpenStack there. And then now I work for a company called Nebula, which is a startup that's trying to do a hardware appliance based on OpenStack. Throughout that time, I have been the technical lead for the compute portion of the project. I was there on the day that the first line of code was written, and I've been working on it ever since then, putting a lot of my time into it. So this is kind of the timeline, just so you get a sense of how quickly this all occurred. First line of code was written in April of 2010. We founded OpenStack in October as a collaboration between NASA and Rackspace. Our company was purchased by Rackspace in 2011. The first public cloud launched using OpenStack happened in October 2011, and then we've had HP launch theirs. Rackspace, which has, I think, the second largest public cloud behind Amazon in the US, has now moved all of their infrastructure over to OpenStack. And then in earlier this year, we actually finally founded what's called the OpenStack Foundation. To give you a scale, there are something like 150 companies involved in the OpenStack Foundation. We have like about 5,000 or 6,000 individual members. It has $4 million of funding from a lot of the big companies. So a lot of really big players have kind of gotten behind this project and decided that this is going to be their cloud strategy. So now you have a basic overview of the history. What the heck is OpenStack? What are we talking about here? So if you go to their website, there's this 5-minute overview that says OpenStack is a global collaboration, and I'm not going to actually read this because who cares, right? Just a bunch of words, blah, blah, blah. So really, I think the only way that you get an idea of what OpenStack is about is if you see it in action. So for those of you that haven't done it before, I'm going to attempt, which is always dangerous because, of course, it's a demo, so it's probably very unlikely to actually work properly. I'm going to give you a demo of OpenStack. And the way that I'm going to run it is using a little script called DevStack, which is something that a few of the developers for OpenStack created, which essentially it's a shell script that's very well documented that tells you how that will download and install the OpenStack components. Now, fortunately, I've Fortunately, I've actually done this before. So most of the dependencies are downloaded, so it's just going to go through the normal install process. And once everything has been downloaded, all the source code's checked out, this generally only takes about a minute to go through. You can see a short list of the things that it's doing. We have 7 core projects now in OpenStack, so it's actually downloading and installing all those projects. It's configuring a bunch of back-end services like a message server, a database server, running all of the API servers, creating credentials, downloading and installing an image so that you can actually run a real virtual machine, installing the dashboard so that we can connect to it and look at it in a visual way, getting your credentials so that you connect to it from the CLI, and we're getting to the point where it's almost done. So essentially, if you'd like to play around, you can't really see this very well because the screen's so small, but if you'd like to play around with OpenStack at some point, there we go, you take a look at devstack.org. It's a really easy way to get started to just fool around with it, see what's going on. It'll just do a single machine install, and essentially it'll work on 1204 precise Ubuntu or Fedora. You should just be able to download it, get clone it, and then basically just do stack.sh, and it should be working. So assuming that we got a success right here. Just so you know, this is a local install, so I'm actually running Ubuntu in a virtual machine on my Mac here and connecting to it that way. One of the cool recent technologies that you can actually do virtualization in virtualization, so I actually have hardware vert nested inside my virtual machine, so it's actually pretty quick. It used to be you had to do this with just software, and so your nested virtual machines would be very, very slow because they're just doing software emulation. Let's see if I can make this small enough that you can actually see it. Okay, so essentially, what we're going to do here, just since it's a quick demo. Basically, the different types of things that you control are over here on the left side. You can see the instances that you have running, which right now will be none. You can see the volumes that you've created, again, none. You can see the images and snapshots. Now, the DevStack script already uploaded a couple of images for us. And then you can control things like key pairs and security groups. If you're familiar with Amazon, these concepts should be familiar to you. If not, then I'm going to give an overview a little bit later about the basic concepts of what's in, what are the basic sort of things that you use in an OpenStack install. So assuming that we're going to have some luck in our demo here, I'm going to click launch. So it says that it's launched. It's going through the different states that it needs to. Should just take about a minute to get to the point where we can see something. Okay. It says we're running. We have an IP address. Now I can go ahead and click here. And we actually have a VNC console, web-based VNC console into the instance. So I can actually look at the virtual machine as it's booting. Now this is a very small Linux install. It's basically a BusyBox-based install just that I use for testing. And so you can see this thing has been up 0 minutes. So it just booted. We have a login. Let's see if I can get out of it. I'm not sure that I can because I don't know if my, oh, wow, I can actually get to the internet too. So I have a virtual machine here. Now, I could do the same thing with a Windows box and I'd actually have a VNC console into a Windows machine. I can boot an Ubuntu server. I can boot a Fedora server. And then once I go in here and customize it, so for example, I could apt-get install different programs, et cetera. And then I could go back. And you could do something like take a snapshot of it. And then so you could take a snapshot, and then you have the snapshot, and you could launch other instances from it. So very sort of easy way to go through and use OpenStack. So does that kind of give you a picture of what we're talking about? We're talking about controlling virtual machines. That six-month process at NASA, or the six-week process at NASA was just 2 minutes for me. So very, very easy way to expose to users to actually get the servers that they need to actually do real work. So to distill that down, what we're providing with OpenStack is a set of APIs for compute, network, and storage. So it's really interesting to be able to do it by clicking on a web dashboard and seeing things, but that's not really the true value. The true value is being able to create distributed applications that can dynamically control compute, network, and storage. So you could create an application that, if it starts getting overloaded, can create more copies of itself, or can be monitoring a database and create more slaves if necessary, things like that. So the real value of cloud isn't just the virtualization component, it's the fast provisioning, and it's the ability to control those with APIs. So it's the ability for you to write scripts or programs that'll actually dynamically create and destroy networks, virtual machines, block devices that you attach to them. So just to give you a little overview of core concepts in OpenStack, these are sort of the basic components that you'll run into in an OpenStack install. You have things, images, you can think of them as snapshots, you can think of them as templates. Basically, the analogy would be a hard drive, a USB hard drive that you plug in and then boot off of, sort of. It's just a frozen version of a state of a non-running machine. We have instances, we have key pairs, volumes, and security groups. So an instance is what we call a virtual machine. Another word for that would be a guest. Sometimes it's called a server. If you go to Rackspace Cloud Servers, they're called servers. Essentially, it's a virtual server. An image is a virtual machine disk image. You can think of it like a gold master. A snapshot really is just another type of image. Generally, it's an image that you created by booting an instance and then making some changes and then snapshotting it. Volumes are attachable hard drives, persistent block device. It's like a USB drive that you could plug into one computer, then unplug and then plug into another computer. It's persistent. So generally, we think of instances as things that are going to come and go. So when you're designing an application that uses cloud, you would create an instance from your image, and then at some point in the future, that instance could crash or it could die, and then you can create another one. Whereas if you need sort of persistent storage, then you would store it in a volume. And security group is just a collection of sort of firewall rules that block access or allow access into the instance. So essentially, you can think of this as like a virtual firewall. Key pair is a way that you log into your instance. So when you first boot it, you need a way to get to that virtual machine. Usually, you don't want to stick a common password in your gold master because then anybody could log in when it first boots if they know what it is. So you inject a key pair into the instance so that you can log in. So here are some things that you would do with an OpenStack Cloud. Overview diagram. So you can create a key pair, which means there's an API to talk to the cloud and say, hey, give me a key pair, which will auto-generate a public-private key pair, give you the private key, and then store the public key online. You can also upload an existing key pair if you have one. Another thing that you can do is you can launch an instance. You might call this also booting an instance or creating a server. But essentially, you're taking your golden master and say, OK, now start virtualizing this with a hypervisor. You could also launch multiple instances from a single image. And then going in reverse, if you want to take an instance and turn it back into an image, then you snapshot it. Another word for this is in the Amazon world is bundling it. So you bundle it from an instance back into an image. Now, keeping in mind that you're not storing your in-memory, that you're not storing the state of the processor. It's not like a suspend. You're not storing anything in RAM. It's just converting it back into an image. Yeah?
When you borrow on those guest star servers, is there any tool that's running inside so you can inject the password?
Yeah, so he asked, is there any component running inside so that you can inject your password when you boot a server? There is some things that do that. There are various ways to get a password if you can't use a key pair. So usually you use a key pair, but if you're booting a Windows instance, for example, you can't use a key pair. There are ways to inject it right now. We're currently actually working on an alternative approach, which is a much more secure way of getting a password, which is when the guest boots, it will generate a password, encrypt it with your public key, and then post it to the cloud so that you can then get the encrypted password, decrypt it, and then use that to log in. The reason that we attempt to do that is we want to avoid as much as possible modifying guest images. Because if you think of a cloud environment, there's sort of an expectation that I can create any kind of virtual machine that I want and boot it, and that the cloud provider is not going to mess with it before they boot it. Password injection usually requires like mounting the file system and doing nasty things. So we try in OpenStack to find ways around messing with people's images before we boot them. But there are use cases like needing a password that we have to fill. So the current approach is to do an injection, and then we have a future approach, which is to do secure password generation and then download. So you can attach a volume to an instance, keeping in mind that volumes are like block devices. You can't plug them into five instances at once. They're not NFS shares. It's a block device. You plug it in. You have to detach it and plug it in somewhere else. And then finally, security group, which allows incoming connections to an instance. Let's just actually pause for a second. Am I going too quickly? Is that clear? Do I need to back up for anyone? OK. One question here, yeah.
Do you have any support for like
the EC2
you have EDS-backed instances where the root device is on EDS volume?
Yes. There is exactly that. Oh, sorry. Thank you. So the question was, do we have any support for EBS-backed instances where the root device is an actual block device? And yes, so we call that boot from volume. And actually, OpenStack provides an EC2-compatible API, so you can actually use your old EC2 semantics to boot off of an EBS-backed instance in the same way. The semantics inside of the Nova API are a little bit unclear, and we're working actually during this release to clarify the semantics so that it's very, very simple to do that. Right now, you have to do something similar to the way that Amazon works. We have to pass in a block device mapping saying, okay, these three block devices are back to volumes and et cetera. Not exactly the most useful thing when all you want is to boot off of a persistent volume. But yes, it's possible to do so. And we're working on making it even more streamlined to do that, because it's something a lot of people like to do. So just a little bit of deep dive into the different projects. So I said that we had 7 core projects. First of all, I want to point out that primarily the focus of OpenStack is at the bottom. If you've seen this chart before or something like it, it's pretty prevalent to understand the difference between software as a service, platform as a service, and infrastructure as a service. But just in case you haven't heard of it before, usually infrastructure as a service is controlling things that are actually normally controlled by hardware. And there actually isn't a requirement that it uses virtualization, but it tends to. So you could have an API to controlling hardware machines. In fact, we've been working on some code in OpenStack to do what we call bare metal cloud. Then platform as a service is essentially other systems generally where you can think of things like Heroku, Google App Engine, where essentially a developer will give code and not worry about how it's running, what servers it's on, or configuring and installing the operating system. Just says, here's the code, make it run, make it scale. And then there's software as a service, which actually provides a real piece of software, something like what Salesforce does, or even Gmail is a great example of software as a service. So in OpenStack, we primarily focus on infrastructure as a service. We're not opposed necessarily to some things. There's kind of a gray line between infrastructure and platform in some places, so we're not opposed to some of those expanding out slightly, but our core value is to focus on making infrastructure as a service really good. We're not really too concerned about the higher layers. And you can see that from what we're doing in our core projects. So our core projects right now, remember initially I said that we started with just compute and storage. Those are the top two. So right now we have compute, object storage, networking, block storage, an image service, an identity service, and a dashboard. Now you'll notice that pretty much all of these are infrastructure. You could make a case that object storage is more platform. You could definitely make a case that the dashboard is more platform, but we consider those part of having a good user experience of cloud, and so they fit kind of into the core experience of infrastructure. So what do each of these projects do? Nova, that's the project that I lead, is responsible for managing virtual machines. It's good to note that it supports multiple hypervisors, so it supports KVM and ZenAPI the best. Hyper-V just got added in the last release, and it's work being done by Microsoft. It's working pretty well now. And VMware is currently reworking the existing ESX code so that it's more powerful. There is some ESX code in there, but it doesn't really support all the features of the other hypervisors, so it's coming in line. So I'm thinking at the Grizzly release, we should have a pretty solid support from KVM, Xen, ESX, and Hyper-V. It also supports some other interesting configurations like LXC containers. Instead of using actual virtualization, you should use container-based virtualization. And it also supports, or it will be supporting bare metal installs as well, where it'll actually pixie boot and install an image onto a real server for you. So object storage, this is similar. You can think of this as like Amazon S3, if you're familiar with that. It's essentially just a place where you store blobs of data that's replicated and redundant and scales very, very well in commodity hardware. So there are very extremely large installs of the object storage system in place. It backs all of Rackspace Cloud files, which has a huge amount of data in it. And it's very good at scaling up and and managing three copies of the data in different locations.
Could you put disk images into it?
You can. In fact, when I get to the image service, I'll explain this. But the question was, can you put disk images into Swift? In fact, that's what most people do. Most people store their cold images in something like Swift or Swift itself. Networking. So you kind of have to have some sort of networking in order to make virtual machines work, just like you have to have some kind of block storage to make virtual machines work. Initially, when the project first started, we had Nova doing all of that. And as we supported more and more backends and more plugin architectures, et cetera, and more people joined the project, we realized that it's very hard to manage. We had something like 72 different committers every month in Nova at one point. It's hard to manage that number of different pieces of the code moving at the same time. So we started separating it out into giving a unique project to control networking in a much more dynamic way, and a unique project to control block storage in a much more robust way. So networking is actually, this is actually a very interesting component, because what it allows you to do is create virtual layer 2 and layer 3 networks on top of whatever current infrastructure you have. And this is, it has a whole bunch of different backends. The default just uses Open vSwitch, and there's proprietary plugins from a lot of different companies to either do it better or do it faster or to talk to real hardware, et cetera. So Cisco's working on plugins for this. NEC, there's a lot of very large companies that are putting into a lot of work into making this very interesting. So essentially what you can do is you can, when you create a virtual machine, you can create multiple networks and attach your virtual machine into those networks so that you can actually isolate groups of servers from each other. Nova supported this initially in a very sort of simplified way. There were two options. One is you put everything on the same network. The other is each tenant gets its own VLAN. And those worked okay, but it's not really configurable or dynamic. We have a lot of customers and users of the system that want to do much more than that. And so Quantum is what gives us the ability to start really interesting things. We can plug load balancers, virtual load balancers in between components, virtual firewalls in between components, et cetera. The block storage system, so this was originally also part of Nova and then was split out. Just to focus on managing block storage devices, we've had a lot of contributions from vendors, people like NetApp, SolidFire, to actually make Cinder be sort of a proxy front end to talk to a hardware device. It also has a default install, which will just basically control LVM and iSCSI target on your local machines and sort of do a dynamic commodity block storage system. Not necessarily redundant like some of the other systems might be, but at least it's cheap. Then the image service. So image service is basically, you could think of it as essentially just a metadata service that can also alternatively serve up images if need be. But most of the time, this is sort of just like a proxy layer to another backing service. So it'll be a proxy layer to something like Swift or S3 or some other place where you're just going to store blobs of data and then give it enough metadata to know that this is an image that a machine can be booted from. So you'll put things like what OS type the image has on it, what architectures it runs on, whether it needs special networking drivers, et cetera. One of the things we realized early on when we started expanding, we had two projects and we added a third and then we added a fourth. We started to realize that if all of these projects have their own identity system, then it becomes very difficult for an administrator to use the projects because you have to configure and sync users and tenants and groups and projects across all of the different systems. So we realized we needed sort of a shared identity service, which could be one place where all of that stuff lives. And our goal wasn't necessarily to recreate the wheel, but we wanted a consistent way to talk to the service regardless of what identity service might be in use in a company behind. So we tried to create a nice level of abstraction where Keystone's responsible for authenticating a user and providing a token to represent that authentication and then mapping roles to some underlying structure. Now that could be LDAP, it could be stored in a database by Keystone itself, but the idea is that most companies already have a way of dealing with users and roles, and we need to provide a consistent thing for all of the OpenStack projects to be able to use that. And so that's what Keystone's responsible for. Finally, we have the dashboard, which is the thing that I showed you at the beginning. It's a web interface to talk to OpenStack. And this isn't really an infrastructure as a service component, but we find that, I mean, this may be the one group that's an exception of any group that I've talked to, but most groups, if I pull up a terminal and I start typing in commands, their eyes glaze over. I think this group, probably that wouldn't happen, but there's something about being able to see in a web interface graphically and actually see the screen pop up that kind of makes it feel real. And without that, you sort of don't get that initial, like, oh, I understand what OpenStack is doing. So we feel like it's kind of a core component to have as there. That said, a lot of the big companies that are providing OpenStack public clouds have written their own dashboards or heavily modified the existing dashboard. We made it very customizable, so it is possible to skin it and move things around really easily. But you know, everybody has to differentiate somehow, so a lot of them do that by providing their sort of dynamic, cool dashboard on top of OpenStack. So next I'm going to talk a little bit about how OpenStack is managed. Like, how do we do this? How do we manage, you know, a few thousand members? And we have something like, I think we've had over 500 developers now across the projects, which is quite a lot of people. It's been moving very quickly. It's only a couple years old. So what we realized very early on, it was initially started by NASA and Rackspace. NASA can't really own any IP. So they have sort of ways that they can get around it, but they couldn't actually kind of become part of a project that wasn't a nonprofit. So they kind of had to donate the code, and then Rackspace started by running they started a limited liability company called OpenStack LLC, and they started running it and managing it themselves. And they've been excellent shepherds for the project. They did an amazing job at getting the word out about it and getting a lot of different of their, even their competitors involved with helping contribute to the project. It's generated a huge amount of buzz. At our last summit, we had 1,500 plus people attend, which is pretty amazing considering it's just a couple years old. But there's been concern that if one company is running the project, then what happens when they don't need it anymore, or what happens if they try and control it and they don't let their competitors in, et cetera. That's been a concern since the beginning. And so one of the first ideas that came out of OpenStack was, hey, let's make a foundation. And so finally this year we founded the OpenStack Foundation. And I just want to give you a little overview of the breakout of the foundation so you understand how it works and how we manage this incredible piece of code. So we have kind of three sort of heads of the foundation. There's a technical committee. The technical committee is responsible for sort of making key technical decisions about where the project goes. It's comprised of mostly members that are the tech leads for the different individual projects, plus a few elected seats. And the people who get elected on the tech committee are actual contributors to the project. So if you've committed, you get a vote. Then there's the board of directors, and this is mainly how the project gets funded. So there are platinum memberships, which is a guaranteed seat on the board, gold memberships, which is all the gold members elect a smaller number of seats, and then there's individual members that are just elected from the general OpenStack member population. So as an example, the platinum members of the board of directors are here. You can see there's some pretty big companies involved that have been committed to using this project. And then finally, there's the user committee. So the general membership has sort of user advocates that advise the board and the technical committee. The board is responsible for sort of funding decisions, key trademark and branding stuff, et cetera. So that kind of explains the business side, which I don't really want to get into that much because it's kind of boring. But I wanted to talk about a little bit more interesting problem is how do you manage the technical direction of the project? So there's a whole bunch of projects that come out and want to be a part of OpenStack for various reasons. So how do we make sure that we can consistently provide a good how do we provide consistently a good release every time we make a release, and how do we ensure that it doesn't kind of the scope doesn't grow to the point where we can't control it anymore? So we have a few common sort of technical points. None of these are hard and fast rules, but these are sort of our general principles, which is that all of the projects should be providing a REST API. And the API is as important as the actual code itself. There's debate that goes back and forth about which is more important. Some people say, no, it's all about the API and whatever, you can change the implementation whenever. And other people say, no, it's all about the implementation and the API can change. But there's a healthy balance between having solid, consistent API and the implementation behind that API. And a lot of the time, the implementation is very pluggable, so it could be replaced with other things. All of our projects right now are written in Python. This isn't a hard requirement. If there was a project that was written in, say, Java that really, really was appropriate for OpenStack, we would definitely consider it. But it's really nice to have a common language so that developers who find a bug in another project that they're using can go in and fix it without having to bug the maintainers and go, hey, that's Java, I have no idea what's going on over there. And then one of the other really common points that we've used is trying to make it really pluggable, so it's sort of a framework, a generalized framework. And we trade off a little bit maybe in usability and installability by making it so pluggable, but we feel like it's really a lot more valuable to a lot more people if they can plug in a different hypervisor, if they can plug in a different hardware appliance to back the networking and the storage, et cetera. Technically, the way that we manage it is we have a bunch of pieces of sort of shared infrastructure. One of the really interesting things is there's a review platform called Garrett, which is used by Android. And essentially, it's a common place where when you make a patch set and you propose it, people can review it and comment on it, and you have to have a certain number of approvals from the core team to actually get your code in. So essentially, we have a very sort of thorough code review process that we go through so that we don't have sort of random breakages going into the code as often. We use Launchpad for bug and feature management. We actually host the code on GitHub, so it's very easy for anybody to get. GitHub is a great way to share code. And then we have a pretty robust continuous integration platform. So essentially, I showed you DevStack earlier. DevStack is one of the main sort of cogs in our integration platform. What we do is we have every time a commit comes in, every time it's proposed, there's a kickoff in a virtual machine using public clouds, actually. There's a kickoff that takes all of the projects, downloads and installs them, and runs a series of integration tests against them and makes sure that they work. And then basically you get red, green on the various tests so that we can be sure before we merge anything that it's going to go off. And then when we actually finally goes through the review process and we click merge, that gate is run again so that in case there's been any changes since the review is initially posted, it's actually still going to be sure not to break any of our integration tests. And then we started collaborating on shared libraries amongst all the projects. So those are various ways that we've, technical choices that we've made that kind of makes this manageable at a large scale. We also have an incubation program. So new projects that are planned on coming in. So we have a couple that are in incubation right now. One is a metering project. One is an orchestration project. Metering is for plugging into billing systems so that you can, know how many of given resources are being used by each of your accounts and then plug that in somewhere so that you can bill them or do chargebacks or whatever. We feel like that's a pretty important piece. And then Heat is an orchestration system. If you use CloudFormation, it's like that. It allows you to define groups of machines as an application and then have it automatically manage the scaling of that application. And then another project that's being worked on is DNS as a service, also kind of a key semi-hardware component that we feel like is useful. But in order for any of these projects to become core projects, they actually have to go through at least a six-month incubation cycle. So they propose to be part of incubation. During that time, we make sure and integrate them with all of the CI components. First, it goes through the technical committee to make sure that we feel like it's actually going in the right direction to be part of OpenStack. And then eventually, at the end of the incubation process, they can be promoted to core. And that's the board of directors. They decide if it's actually good enough or at the point when it's ready to be part of the OpenStack shared release. We have 6-month release cycles, which basically means every 6 months we're dropping a stabilized release of all the components together that's well tested. Our last release was October 2012. It was Folsom. You'll notice that they're named by letter, EFGH. So the Grizzly release will be in April. And the way that we design the features that are going into that 6-month process is we have these things called design summits. So every 6 months we get together, we have a whole bunch of topics that are proposed by different member organizations, different developers, and things that they'd like to see, things that they're planning on working on. We get into a room, sometimes very packed into a room, as in this case. This was some of the networking sessions last time. And the features proposed, we talk about implementation strategies, and we try and come up with a specific plan for either executing the feature or deciding that maybe that's not the best idea. So every 6 months we do that. We coalesce those into a bunch of what we call blueprints, which are feature plans with specs, and then we get started working on it. So for example, the last summit was actually down here in San Diego a couple of months ago, and the next one will be just after the April release, so towards the end of April next year. And this is a really interesting process because there are a lot of people involved in the design and development of the code. It's been quite fascinating to watch it grow from, you know, six to eight developers sitting in a room to 500 developers located all around the world with conferences and user groups and sessions and bug reports. And we've basically, in 2 years, had to grow from very, very small to very, very big. And there's definitely been some growing pains. It hasn't been the easiest transition. But what we've discovered is that keeping kind of a strong core group of people that are committed to making sure that having ownership over the code, you wouldn't actually expect this necessarily in open source. But what I've found is that if people don't feel like they own the code that they're working on, then the quality tends to go down. So it seems very important to have, and it's that ownership is hard to feel when it grows to like 100 or multiple hundreds of people working on the code. So there has to be this sort of balance between keeping people focused on certain areas that they really feel responsible for, and keeping those areas, that's the key to getting those areas maintained. At any point, if there's just, well, there's 70 of us, and someone will look at that area of code, which I don't really care about, those are the areas where we have problems, because there's not someone that's in there going like, this is my code, this is my baby, as it were. And it's sort of non-intuitive, because when you think of open source development in general, you would think that there's this sort of shared mentality of everything is everyone's, but it doesn't really necessarily work that way. So there's, you've got to balance the idea of sharing, where everybody is contributing and working on something that everybody benefits from, with still giving people the opportunity to feel like, hey, I'm an expert in this particular piece. And I think Linux, Linus and the Linux kernel went through this over a much longer period. I think this is kind of how they ended up evolving the sort of subsystem maintainers approach, as they started to realize that their experts naturally develop in certain areas of the code, and if you support that, if you cause that to be the right way to do things, then the code gets better. Whereas if you kind of force everyone to share equally, then the sort of love or ownership, the feeling of responsibility for the code isn't there, and it tends to decrease. So that's been probably one of the most interesting things that's happened out of this gradual growth, or this quick growth, from 8 developers up to over 100. Any questions at this point? Yeah.
I'm surprised to see the big thing you wanted to do was DNS.
Mm-hmm.
You
were surprised to see what? Sorry?
The only one you mentioned was DNS.
On the list, well, future work. Sorry. There's a whole bunch more possible here. The question was, why only DNS on future projects? There seems like there's a lot more infrastructure that could be done. So I was putting in here ones that are actually getting close to being ready to go into incubation. So DNS has had a lot of very focused work recently. There are other ones I could have put. So database as a service is one that's been going on for a while, but it hasn't been directly focused on trying to get into incubation. So this is more like things that we're going to see in the next 6 months as opposed to all the things that we could do over the lifetime of OpenStack. Because, yeah, there's a ton more. I mean, just look at all of the way that Amazon rolls out new services every 2 months. and you get an idea of all the things that could be done. Yeah?
You mentioned doing a new release every 6 months.
Yeah.
How long do the old releases continue to at least get bug fixes?
So that's a very good question. So we have what's called a stable maintenance team, and then we have specific stable teams for each of the past releases. In the current state, most of the attention goes to the previous release. So bug fixes go very heavily into the previous release, and then very sort of critical bug fixes go into the one before that, and any security fixes will go basically to all releases. Right now, our first sort of release that we considered, I didn't go through the actual, yes I did. I don't know where it was, though. The first release that we considered sort of worth trying to support all the way back was Essex. So essentially, as of now, all security features go all the way back to Essex, and that'll probably go on for another year or so, and at some point we'll say, okay, we're not going to put even, Essex is done, end of life, no more security fixes, and security fixes will go through all the releases, and then, so it's kind of a long tail, sort of, a lot of bug fixes in the last release, critical ones in the one before, and then security fixes until the end of the tail. And we haven't defined exactly when we EOL releases yet. Essex is the first one that we're sort of keeping going, and that's now about a year, just over a year old, I think. So it'll probably be something like 2+ years. Yeah, back there. Yeah. So the question is, are there plans to do to work with groups of machines instead of just individual machines? And yes, I would put that. That's essentially what the Heat project is trying to accomplish. So it's about managing groups of machines together, and defining a group that would be, you know, two machines based on this image, three machines based on this image, and you can even do things like at least two up to six of this image. So make sure that there's always at least two, but scale up to six if possible based on monitoring and stuff like that. So it's a pretty robust way of controlling groups of machines. And I think most of the orchestration type of components that'll be responsible for grouping things together will probably end up there because it's a good location for it. It's already kind of got that responsibility. That project is currently in incubation and hopefully will be part of a core release at some point in the next year. The question was, have we looked at Google's Ginetti? So we actually used Ginetti back at NASA for some of our infrastructure servers, but we didn't use it. We used it controlling virtualization, not using bare metal. I actually didn't know that it does bare metal stuff. Are you saying that it does?
Well, I think yesterday's talk seemed like
they do. Okay. Yeah, we haven't looked at it. So most of the bare metal code, it's actually there's a lot of different companies working on it. But it was started by a research company called ISI, which I think is based at USC. Yeah, are they here? and so their initial plan was to basically make they had this thing called a Tylera, which is basically like a very large 64-core x86 machine that can be partitioned into smaller machines. And so they wanted to use that. It doesn't support virtualization, but they can actually allocate different cores to different workloads on this machine. And so they made code to get that working, and in the process realized that as they were doing that, that the code could very easily be modified slightly to do booting via Pixie of actual x86 boxes externally. Then a company in Japan got involved, actually two companies in Japan, NTT and Virtual Tech, got involved and rewrote the code and made it much more robust. And now HP is working heavily on it because they want, I think, make an offering off of it at some point. So it's gone through a lot of iterations and finally getting to the point where it's actually probably going to be powerful enough to do things in sort of an unsafe environment. The big concern about using bare metal is multi-tenancy and, hey, if they have access to the actual network device, they can do nasty things to the other machines on the network. There's no sort of virtualization firewall in between. So you have to control real hardware for the firewalling. You have to do interesting things like making sure that the hard disk is actually securely deleted when the machine shuts down, which is sort of hard because you don't have a supervisor there to do things. So those components are coming in to make it really good for multi-tenancy right now. And at that point, I think it would be very feasible to do actually like a multi-tenancy public bare metal cloud using the software. And the neat thing about it is that it's the same API for doing a bare metal server, for doing an LXC container, and for doing an actual real virtual LXC container, bare metal, and virtual machine all uses the same API. So you could actually have an image that you could boot on all three. And based on your needs, you could say, well, I want to run a whole bunch of these. I want to run like 1,000 of them on one machine, so I want to use LXC containers. I don't really want to deal with the overhead of virtualization. And then you could say, well, this other server, it's a database server, and I can't deal with the I/O overhead of talking to a virtual disk drive. I need a real disk, so I'm going to put this on a bare metal. And you can still control the whole thing through an OpenStack API. You could still control the whole thing using an orchestration layer like Heat and actually have different sort of all of these different components working together under one API. That's sort of the long-term goal. We're not there yet, because the bare metal support isn't to the point where it can be doing really interesting stuff like that.
Hi. You spoke about provisioning instances with golden images. Is there any support for any other methods, like dead bootstrap or jumpstart or anything?
So the way that you create your... that's an interesting question. So there's a lot of different ways that you could create an image. One very simple thing that you can do is take an existing image and use a shell script that you pass in via user data and have it install Puppet for you or something like that and connect to a Puppet server and then Puppet itself up. That's one model that a lot of people use, or similarly with Chef. Then there's people that prefer to sort of build the images locally and then upload them. And there's actually a really interesting thing that I just found out about recently. There's people offering services that allow you to build images based on sort of a manifest, like an XML manifest. And it will build the image for you and upload it to a cloud provider. So you basically will send in this manifest saying, hey, I want a Fedora box with these 7 packages installed, and I want it on Amazon. And you send it in, and it builds the whole thing and then uploads it. And it can do the same thing to an OpenStack cloud. And there's some people working on actually integrating that into our dashboard so that you could actually do that in an OpenStack cloud. There's nothing stopping you from debootstrapping locally, packing it up, and then uploading it to Glance, so that's totally fine. But there isn't like an automated version of that at this point. There's some stuff in the works. Yeah.
Thank you.
So I think one of the key things that OpenStack provides is providing sort of an open innovation platform for a lot of the really interesting things to be done with cloud. What we've seen, and I think the reason when OpenStack was first founded, it didn't have a whole heck of a lot. The object storage system was really good. The compute system was a couple months old. It couldn't do all that much. It was basically just like a sort of Python version that could do essentially what Eucalyptus could do, not a whole lot at that point, a couple years ago. Gave you sort of a mini version of Amazon behind the firewall. But it got a huge amount of momentum really quickly, and the reason was because that people, there are a lot of people that wanted to innovate and couldn't because they were hamstrung by the fact that Amazon was this sort of de facto standard. So Amazon came out and said, okay, we're the 800-pound gorilla in the room, we're going to innovate really quickly, and we're going to provide all these features, but they're not extensible, they're not standards, you have to, you know, just sort of wait for us to lead the way in every respect. And so all of the other providers who kind of missed the boat on cloud initially are like, well, we want to catch up, but there's this person way out in front, and we don't have the development resources individually to catch up with that mammoth. And so they all kind of banded together and said, what if we use open source to kind of even out the scales? And what that means is now we have a set of open APIs that anybody can contribute to create these new features and to kind of shape the way that cloud is going without having to depend on one company to shape everything, which means that what we're looking to have here is shared APIs, shared infrastructure. We can start federating between clouds. It becomes very, very easy to start moving things around because we have move towards a standard. So I see at some point, assuming all goes well, that the same thing's gonna happen that happened with TCP, HTTP, where at some point, this is just the way that things are done. And we stop thinking about things in terms of how do I control a virtual machine and which library do I need to download and how do I get my authentication credentials installed properly and do I use JClouds because it's across, we get beyond those options and we just start thinking of cloud in the same way that we would compile a C program. It's just you compile it, it's done, and you go. And then that's when we start really seeing some of the interesting stuff in the future of where cloud can go. I feel like we're just at the beginning of what is possible. There's a lot more potential out there. So I really hope that we continue to innovate and make some cool stuff. I'm pretty much done. Is there any last minute questions before we can break a little early?
Use the mic, please.
Hi, I'm Larissa Shapiro. I'm just wondering what flavor of DNS you're using for your DNS as a hosted infrastructure?
So like all of the other OpenStack projects, the idea is for it to be pluggable. I actually don't know what the default implementation is going to be. Maybe it's going to be bind. But it's the idea is that it's
agnostic, sort of?
Yeah, that we provide a front end, and then the provider can plug in whatever DNS backend they would like to make it actually do the work.
Cool. Yeah. Thank you.
How would you answer the sort of criticism that's been made of OpenStack that the blistering array of choices available has made it quite complicated to understand and seems to be a consistent problem in keeping the documentation up to date?
I think it's a solid criticism. And it's something that we're attempting to address. I mean, it's the price that we pay for being so flexible is that it is very hard to... it's not something that's easy to sort of use out of the box, as it were, and it's somewhat hard to keep up with documentation. But I think what's going to happen is it's going to turn into more of, in the same way that most people, when they're coming to Linux, don't just go use Linux. They don't say, I'm going to go find Linux. They find Ubuntu, or they find, you know, these days Mint is really popular. So you find some more accessible way of using it that is sort of a opinionated version that maybe hides a lot of that complexity from you. But you wouldn't say that just because there are those versions that the goal is to take all of the incredible amount of features in Linux out. And that's kind of where OpenStack, I think that's where we want to be with OpenStack. And in the early stages, it is a little bit painful because we don't have the best documentation and there aren't enough experts, et cetera. But I think long term it's the right way, because what we're going to have is we're going to have a very configurable system like something like Linux that's a core, and then we're going to have different companies or distributions providing sort of simplified versions that are more user-friendly and easier to kind of start with.
Are there any of those available right now for people to dip their toes in with?
So the question was, are there any sort of simpler installations that are available right now? I know Ubuntu's been working very hard on getting essentially apt-get install OpenStack to work, which is a great way to get started. And then Red Hat is in beta for their sort of offering. So I think those are probably going to be the really easy initial versions. My company is working on doing it in a hardware appliance, which is definitely more on the user-friendly end. Plug it in and it just works. You don't have to install or configure anything. So I think those are going to be where we're going to see a lot of the better documentation, the user experience, because it's very hard to manage that stuff with a large community to keep that is changing so quickly, to keep all of that working well. But we do love help with documentation and testing, et cetera. And Gentle's our sort of manager for all of the documentation stuff, and she does an excellent job, and she can always use more help. So if any of you out there are running into problems, please give us feedback and help us clean things up. The question was software-defined networks. What's the plan? So Quantum is the plan. I mentioned Quantum. Quantum is actually part of the core release now. A lot of companies are using it already. Rackspace is using it internally for their public cloud. They don't expose the ability to define networks to users, but essentially it's doing a really good job of abstracting all of the possibilities that you could define in a network over real hardware into something that people could use. I actually didn't do my little local install with Quantum enabled. I should have so that I could show you, but basically you can just go in and say, give me a network, and then associate a subnet with that network, then make another network, associate a subnet. When you launch the instance, you can say, attach it to these four networks. And then the future of that is putting firewall rules and things like that on top that you can define flows sort of dynamically as well. But I think that's one place where OpenStack is actually on the cutting edge of things. There isn't really anybody who's done full software-defined networking well on a cloud level, and I think OpenStack is going to be the first to really provide some of the advanced functionality there.
Thank you.